Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm so pleased to welcome back Chief Tainar Simpson of the Alderville First Nation.
Thank you, Robert. It's always happy to be here.
Before we talk about what's going on in Alderville, it may be useful to refresh our memories about the tragedy of residential schools and the significance of the discovery of unmarked graves in Canada.
Yes, I think it's an issue that, a couple of years ago, it was at the forefront of the national dialogue. But it seems like as time goes on, not only are people forgetting the severity of it, the deniers are starting to come out of the woodwork more. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but Thomas Flanagan has struck again, and he's got a new book out called Grave Error, I believe it's called. And it discusses, it's basically denying the tragedies of the residential schools.
I'd like to talk a bit about that later, but for now, could you give us a bit of background about how it became part of the national dialogue?
Well, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that my background experience has been with the residential school system since the late 1990s. And this is something we always knew existed. We had always heard about the unmarked graves that were behind the schools. There was eyewitness accounts of the students who had seen these type of things. So we'd always known that these graves were there. So it actually just took this long for someone to say, hey, we're going to go try to look for these graves as technology improved. So Kamloops were able to hire a GPR, ground penetrating radar specialists, and they identified 215 disturbances in the ground behind the residential school.
There are a number of calls to action in the Truth and Reconciliation Report speaking directly to the issue of children who died and were buried in unmarked graves. Can you tell us a bit, first of all, about the National Death Registry?
The National Death Registry is hosted by the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, where we have accumulated all of the deaths that we know through the records occurred at the residential schools. So this list has, there's thousands of names on this list, as well as what we found in the last couple of years that we are still parsing through to make sure we get all the information just right before we put any new information on the registry, because we don't want to put in a name that's wrong or a duplicate name. So we want to get this just right, considering how important it is for the survivors' families.
I understand there's also something called the Memorial Registry. Could you explain what that is?
That's a good question. I actually don't know the answer to that. I wasn't involved specifically on the Memorial Registry, but I can look into that and get back to you.
What is the Unmarked Burials Project?
Well, the Unmarked Burials Project, it's a national scope where ideally, every single residential school would have ground penetrating radar done. I know in Ontario, the Anishinaabeg Nation is actually going to be passing a resolution. I am the first mover on it, where we are going to provide the methods and methodologies for the schools and the communities to be able to access funding to get GPR and other technicians on the lands. And it's not just for the First Nations that had residential schools close to them. It's for any reserve that had residential schools survivors, which is all of them.
The last question before we get into what's going on locally is, how would you characterize the progress being made to find and register these unmarked graves nationally? You just mentioned one thing that's going on. What else is going on within this region and across the country?
Well, I would say right now we're still in infancy of addressing this issue. there hasn't been a national mandate to do this type of work. So you have all of the individual First Nations doing their own thing. So it's a patchwork right now. So you have universities being engaged by First Nations that have the technology. You have private companies coming in to do this work. You have individuals that are able to do it. So there's no one national framework that can come in and do this. So I think this is the next step, is getting it so that it's not a matter of we can't find the funding, we can't find the technicians, there's no time. It needs to be done across the board at every residential school. And that's the next step, really.
I understand you have recently done some work on finding unmarked burials in Alderville. Can you tell us about this?
Yes. So a few years ago, we had some ground penetrating radar done at the church grounds. We have an Alderville church that's 153 years, I want to say. And so we know that there would have been people buried there. And it's also beside the site of Canada's first industrial school that was opened up in the 1830s and closed down before the turn of the century, that being the 20th century. So we know that there could be deaths from there that are also in these grounds. So the initial GPR results had hits that said that there were disturbances in the ground and most likely burials. So this past year, we had another GPR specialist come in where more was done. And they found more disturbances as well as foundations of buildings that we didn't know existed. So we are still going through that information because it's not like it says there's definitely an unmarked burial here. You see disturbances, so you don't really know what they are. So we can go back into our records and see if there's anything we can find. But we do know that there were likely burials behind the church. Maybe they were marked at one point, but the markings are gone. We know that there were various outbreaks of disease in the 1800s, where they might have buried people in large numbers.
I wanted to get some clarification about that, because it wouldn't make a lot of sense that there would be burials near a church.
Well, Alderville was formed as a mission in 1837. So the church and the industrial school would have worked hand in hand. And since they were side by side, you could see that they were run by the same individuals. We know for the most part that when people passed in Alderville, they were buried on their property, were at their homestead. And we also have a cemetery where everyone else, once that cemetery was opened, everyone is pretty much buried there. So the church itself was never a sanctioned area for burials. So we wouldn't really be expecting to find people buried in this area.
I want to talk a little bit more about the history of the industrial school, because obviously, this is seminal, and I understand that in 1848, there was an initial school that was a joint project between the Wesleyan Church and the Anishinaabe people. Tell us a little bit more about the school and its history.
Well, the industrial school started as almost like a pilot project, where the intentions were good. I guess the government officials at the time thought, you know what, we are trying to basically assimilate Indigenous people. Now, what do they need to be successful in our life, our way of doing things? So the industrial school taught farming, it taught carpentry, and it's a lot of our members today are farmers and carpenters, and it's something that we did learn those skills. So it didn't have the ill intent that the residential schools had. So you would have students coming from far and wide, because there wasn't as many industrial schools as there were residential schools. So not every First Nation would have one. In fact, it was very rare. In Alderville being the first, you would have First Nations from across the whole region coming to attend this school. I've seen the list of the names of the students at the school, and you will get the occasional Alderville members, and maybe more than any other First Nation, but you had all these other names that you recognized from other First Nations, not being Alderville.
Is it not true, though, that the Indigenous people made financial contributions and had a say in the governance of the industrial school at the very beginning?
I would say more so than the residential schools. They also didn't take students who were only 6 years old, 5 years old, and force them into these schools. These were, for the most part, I'm not going to say voluntary, but they didn't round people up and force them into them. They were slightly older students as well, too, of the age, of working age. I mean, back in the 1800s, the working age was a lot younger than it is today, but they were still deemed of the age that they could be partaking in this type of work.
So how do the burials then relate to the residential school, or do they at all? Is that the relationship, or is it related to something else?
That's what we don't know. Unless you actually start digging and finding physical evidence, we won't know. We can try to look for archival documents and records, which is basically what I've been doing on a national scale. Once you know where someone might be and who that person is, that gives you a bit more evidence, but we don't really know. We have a few names of people who passed away at the industrial school, so that would be probably the first place to start. But you would think that maybe they would have been returned to their community, but at this time we don't know. We're talking almost 200 years ago. Records weren't that well kept, and any physical evidence might not be preserved very well. But it's very difficult to go and digging. It's easy to take a shovel to the ground, but that's not what you want to do, especially since some of these people who passed away could have been from infectious diseases. And we've been warned that indeed that you could, the disease, the parasite, or the virus might still be active. So you kind of want to leave that in the ground, just to err on the side of safety.
What is the culturally appropriate thing to do in this case to honor traditions for burials?
Well, that's a very good question. We're still figuring that out. I have one example of what we did in Kingston, where some burials were found in actually at the CFB, the Canadian Forces Base in Kingston. And what was decided was to actually just keep the burials in place. They didn't dig them up or anything. They built a garden around it with the sacred medicines, a monument, like a plaque that spoke about what was happening there and the history of it. So they decided they were just going to leave everything in place and honor them as they were. And to me, that seems like a really good way to go forward instead of trying to dig everyone up and put everything together and trying to identify, because if you can't identify them, then what can you do with the remains? If you reinter them in the same spot, then really what was the whole purpose of it? So I think right now they're in the ground, and until we know exactly how to proceed, it's best where to keep them where they are and let the communities decide.
Does this project help give closure, even though it might open old wounds?
Very much so, because we had several eyewitnesses that that said that they saw these things happening, that their friend disappeared, that people walked off in the night with basically a body. They saw that they came back an hour later without that. So they put two and two together. They knew someone was buried there. They told people, and for decades they were told, nope, that wasn't the case. So we had all these people that knew that they were there. Families that heard these rumors, but now to know, for the families to know that indeed they are most likely there's a place that they can go and honor them in a good way. I think it brings a tremendous deal of closure.
How about in the Alderville community? How does it help the Alderville community heal?
Well, I think it's a recognition of the past, knowing that everything that had been done to us through assimilation and what we now know as cultural genocide, to be able to have a place to go to remember that, to have ceremony, to honor our ancestors who would be there. I think it's it helps us understand our place in the world today.
For the broader community of Northumberland, how does sharing this project move us closer to reconciliation?
Well, that's the ongoing task of what we're doing. I do feel a sense of need and urgency on the outside community for reconciliation. You also have that section of the population that's always going to be denying that these things happened and that they were bad things. So I think you need these places of recognition, these memorials, these histories to be coming forward to combat that that negative message, because that negative message just always keeps getting stronger. And unless you face it full on with facts, then those other negative, ignorant facts will eventually take over. And we've seen that happen many times.
Good to be talking to Tainar Simpson. And this time we're going to be talking about policing. It's my understanding that there was a community meeting recently about policing in Alderville. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yes. So we actually went up to Rama, which is a First Nation by Orillia, for a policing convention. And there was representatives from the OPP and other police services, the federal government, and the First Nations. So we really just were able to talk about all the options that are around, and also with the grievances that we have about non-representative policing. So we, Alderville just desperately needs policing that meets our needs, respects our laws, and also an increased presence in the community too.
So I know in the past there's been multiple efforts to create Indigenous police forces across Ontario. What has happened in the past?
Well, our neighboring First Nation in Hiawatha across Fraser Lake is a really good example of the First Nation policing services that was an option back in the 90s. Alderville chose not to go that route, but we know Hiawatha has their own police force. They've got their cars, they've got boats, and they have a police force that is present in the community where the community members can see that they're there. The federal government doesn't offer that anymore, so we aren't able to get in on that programming. One of the options is maybe potentially we could work out an agreement with Hiawatha and have a satellite office. I know that that's been thrown around before. I'm not sure if that's an option because we have to discuss that with our neighbors. You also have something called the Aboriginal Police Services, APS, and that's, I'm not sure if they're allowing new First Nations into that right now. I think there's been a pause, but right now it seems like the governments are just analyzing the way forward right now, because whatever's been going on doesn't work. Like nothing has actually been perfect so far, and Alderville's missed the boat on even those imperfect solutions.
Can you describe for us what the role of the provincial government and the OPP are like historically for Alderville?
Well, the OPP, we have a really good relationship with them. I like the all the officers there. Their detachment commander is great. The main issue is that the province and the OPP, they aren't able to enforce our laws. So we could pass the law, like a trespassing law, but they don't actually have the mandate to enforce these laws, which makes our laws basically meaningless. We can have all the laws we want, but if there's no enforcement of those laws, they might as well not even be existing. They're not worth the paper they're written on.
We saw this play out about a year or so ago. Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tainar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tainar Simpson, the chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you are joining us, somebody from the First Nation Reserve. Can you explain how it might go if you had your own police force?
Yes, and that's what I would consider an extreme case. And unfortunately, that the community and chief and council of the time, which I wasn't a part of, decided that was the best way forward. I know in previous instances when I was on council, especially during COVID, we were basically the law. We were going, we hired security guards at great expense to make sure that, the COVID laws, we had an emergency order at the time, were being followed, and they weren't being followed by some. So we wanted to make sure and have a presence, but that was just too expensive, and counselors and chiefs aren't supposed to be going out and enforcing the laws in that regard. So last year when we had that incident, I think that's when it really came to the forefront that's not the way it should be, that something has to be better. Like, we should have been able to have a police officer go there, give them like an eviction notice, and you know, just confirm that they got that, and then that's it. But as you can see, that's not what happened.
Once you get the logistics in place, what are the challenges that you face in terms of actually creating a police force?
Well, a few years back, we were basically moving forward on our own. We actually put in a trust application, Alderville Williams Treaty Trust, and we received funds to convert one of our buildings into a police headquarters. So we were ready. We were going to retrofit a building. We just needed police officers. So we are ready. It's fertile ground for our own police services. A number of our members are actually police officers. So like we know that once we had that, we would probably be getting interested members being officers, or other First Nations members being officers here. So we feel like once we have the framework to move forward with, it's going to be pretty easy. Funding shouldn't be an issue, because all communities are funded by the province and the feds for policing. So we would just imagine that that would go into there, because right now the OPP is being funded for two officers for Alderville, but we don't see those officers in Alderville. They pass through. They do stop some speeders now and then, but generally they're used for the overall detachment catchment area at, you know, priority. So like if there's an accident, then they're OPP, they have to go to that. They are not going to just sit here in Alderville. So we're not really seeing what we want. We want that police presence. We want, you know, maybe an officer, you know, going up and down Vimy Road or the roads at our public events. It'd be great if an officer is going there and, you know, talking to the kids and the students, and just being there and showing, hey, Alderville's got police. we're a law and order area. So that's really what we're shooting for.
So what's the next step then?
The next step is coming up with an agreement with the province and the Crown to come up with an agreement where we have policing who are based in Alderville, who will honor our laws, enforce our laws, and also, most importantly, understand the culture of Alderville. So we are slightly different from other people in Canada, and the police who are here in the community would need to be aware of that. So I feel like we're close. Like I wouldn't be surprised if we have something in a year or 2 years, but at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't have anything in 5 years. It's one of those things where we're just always having it on the agenda. It's something we're always pushing for, and one of these days that door is gonna push down and we're gonna get what we're looking for.
I want to thank you for talking about policing. I understand you have some announcements to share with us.
Yes. Well, we have quite an exciting time coming up. I guess the big announcement is we recently purchased 275 acres of land just north of us along the Rice Lake and Trent River shore. So this is the biggest land purchase we've had in our neck of the woods for Alderville probably ever. So right now we're in engagement and discussions with the community about what that should look like. What are we going to do with this? About two thirds of it's forested and one third is farmland. So we're going to be looking to engage with the community in the coming weeks and months on that. Another exciting thing coming down the pipes is the custom election code ratification vote. So this is going to be where we take control of our elections and we can decide how those elections are run. So we're having community engagement this month and next. And really big news, well, everything's really big news. We've got our Alderville app is available for download at the Apple App Store as well as Google Play. And this is where you're going to have a one-stop shop for everything happening in Alderville, all the events. So instead of going to our various Facebook pages, you know, it's all going to be right there. So it's a work in progress, but I do urge everyone to go and download the Alderville app. And you don't need to just be a member. Even non-members can download the app and find out what's available to the public. Anything that is open to the public, such as the powwow, things like that, they're going to be able to access. Now, in terms of specific dates, on April 22nd, we have our roadside and waterway cleanup from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and this is for Earth Day. We do this every year. It's a council-led thing where we take our garbage bags and our garbage stick, and we go, we clean up all the sides of the roads and the water shore, so it looks good. On April 27th, we're having our third drum and dance social potluck. This is something that we used to do in the past, but we brought back this year. It's open to members and non-members. So we got a lot of people from Roseneath coming in. So it's a great dinner and there's lots of drumming and singing. So I think anyone who hasn't experienced that, they're welcome to come out and see that on the 27th. In the last weekend of April and the first weekend of May, is a free driver's ed education at the community center. So if you're a youth and you want to learn how to drive, like my daughter who's 16, I'm really trying to get her to come to this. So it's free, and it's you know, safe driving is important, and a lot of kids get their license without taking the education. I think it's really important to avoid accidents and all things like that. On May 11th is our Lands Fest. And this is from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's brought to you by our Lands and Estate Department, as well as our Lands Advisory Committee. So it's going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be dancing, drumming, vendors, games, prizes, as well as announcing who the logo contest winner is. So my sister's on that council, so she's really been talking about it a lot. On May 15th, that's the post-secondary funding application deadline for all of our students who are going to post-secondary education. Make sure you get your application in by then. And that concludes my announcements.
Dinner Simpson, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Robert.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.